From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, another push for regional transit for Southeast Michigan.
And make sure the communities that need better connections the most aren't held back by the areas where there's less demand.
Using brain scans to fight the stigma of mental illness, especially in the young.
Children with mental health problems are the diagnostic and therapeutic orphans of American healthcare.
Poet Cal Freeman on his new collection, Fight Songs.
That's really important in poetry, to have some consciousness of social justice underpinning your work.
A challenge to Michigan's theatergoers.
Get a little bit outside your zone. Explore some of these new theaters, which are doing wonderful work.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When Detroit jumped into the national scrum to win the second Amazon headquarters, a big deficiency became glaringly obvious. Amazon wants access to public transit for that $5 billion second headquarters with its 50,000 jobs. And Southeast Michigan gets a big zero for regional public transportation. Well, now we're hearing elected officials of Detroit, along with Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties, have been meeting, trying to hammer out a new regional transit plan with the hopes of going back to voters again in November to try again to pass a transit tax. Here with us, Megan Owens, Executive Director of Transportation Riders United. Megan, what do we know about these meetings of elected officials?
We don't know a great deal. These have definitely been happening in private, but the heads of Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb counties, as well as the city of Detroit, those executives have been meeting periodically for much of the past year, and their deputies meeting even more frequently to try to figure out a regional transit solution that they can all get behind. Back in 2016, when there was a previous effort, Detroit and Wayne County, as well as Washtenaw County, were all strongly supportive, but Oakland and Macomb leadership were quiet. They did not actively oppose it, but they didn't actively support it. And there's a lot of concern that may have been one of the factors in why it lost by a smidge last time.
Oh, you're not kidding. Teeny, tiny margin, around 1%, really a handful of votes. So the meetings are happening in private. Does that concern you, or might one argue that you need to hammer out these differences behind closed doors before you open the door and present something to the world?
I will admit I'm a little torn. I definitely believe better solutions come from more voices involved, but I recognize that these leaders do need to come to agreement, and in the discussions I've had, they should be coming up with something soon, and they certainly know what the issues and concerns are in terms of how do we make sure we really connect our community so you can get from one county to the other, because our lives don't end at our city or county's borders, and yet make sure that people aren't being taxed for something that their community isn't benefiting from. So I'm very optimistic that they're going to come up with a great solution, and there certainly will be plenty of opportunity over the next 10 months to discuss and to provide input as to how to make it the best it can be for our region.
Certainly, we heard from opponents of the regional tax, folks who lived in northern Oakland and northern Macomb counties, like, what's in it for us? So could you see a restructuring where people who would really not, be served by a regional transit authority wouldn't have to pay for it?
That is one of the things that's being discussed. The reality is we all pay for services that we don't directly personally use. I mean, I certainly hope I never have to use the fire department, but I'm happy to pay my taxes for it. But that said, there is some discussion of whether the very rural areas in northern Oakland and Macomb, in western Washtenaw County, whether those areas could be removed from the RTA's jurisdiction and make sure that all of the urban and suburban areas are well connected by transit. That would require going back to the legislature, so the timing would need to move pretty quickly, but that is one of the options under consideration to make sure the communities that need better connections the most aren't held back by the areas where there's less demand.
Megan, could Amazon actually manage to accomplish something that has never, ever, ever happened before, as in uniting Detroit and the suburbs to pull off a regional transit system to Southeast Michigan?
I'm not sure if we can give all of the credit to Amazon. This is something that's been in the works for many years, and the discussions were going on well before the Amazon announcement. But it certainly did spur a little more attention and interest. There have been people who said, hey, I drive, why should I care? And hearing how important transit is to new economy businesses like Amazon helps remind people, helps people understand, even if you don't personally use it, our region and your neighbors may dramatically benefit if we have better transit. So the Amazon deal may be a good encouragement to get this important effort done.
Megan Owens, Transportation Riders United Executive Director. As always, Megan, thanks so much.
Oh, happy to be with you.
One of the key roles of a state attorney general is protecting consumers. A guest editorial today in Bridge Magazine accuses Michigan Attorney General Bill Schuette of a weak track record of consumer protection in our state. The editorial is written by Michigan State University law professor Mark Totten, who ran on the Democratic ticket against Mr. Schuette in 2014. Mark Totten, welcome to Stateside.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me on, Cynthia.
So I'm going to quote you from the editorial piece that you wrote in Bridge. Here's your quote. Under Bill Schuette, Michigan has one of the weakest consumer protection programs in the nation. So what's the basis for that claim?
Well, look, we've known for a long time that the Michigan Attorney General hasn't been doing what needs to be done in the area of consumer protection. But what we particularly have in hand now is a study that I was a part of. It was a multi-author team, including a former consumer protection chief from the Minnesota AG's office. And what we did was a first-of-its-kind study looking at how attorneys general enforce their state consumer protection acts. So it was a massive collection of data. We sent these open record requests, sometimes called Freedom of Information requests, to every attorney general in the United States. And we got 100% response rate, which we certainly were not expecting. We were able to assemble around 800 cases. These were all of the cases that were brought under a state consumer protection act in 2014. And we had about 800 cases. And then we looked at every one of them. We asked about 200 questions of every one of these cases. And we were able to get really a snapshot of what the enforcement of state consumer protection law looked like across the United States. And that had never happened before. It was really hard to, you know, try to figure out who was good at enforcement and who wasn't.
And so you looked at volume of cases, you looked at relief obtained for consumers and leadership in large multi-state lawsuits. So where did Michigan rank?
You know, Michigan was very low in the rankings, probably in around the bottom one-third, as I mentioned in the article. I think that's highly surprising. I mean, Michigan is one of the largest states in the nation. And if you look where states show up, there's real reasons to be concerned. Some of the smallest states in the nation, like Vermont, Iowa's got around 3 million people, were extremely proactive in terms of protecting consumers. Republican states were as well. It wasn't simply partisan. States like Texas and Florida, which both have Republican attorneys general, came out quite strong in terms of protecting consumers. But Michigan, at least in 2014, had very little to show in terms of protecting consumers. And it became pretty clear pretty quick that 2014 was not an exception.
You do note in your editorial that most of the releases that the attorney general has put out were about large multi-state cases, right? Most of which other states led and Michigan really wasn't a part of. So are you saying, is he taking a bow for work done by other states' attorneys general?
You know, I think certainly as readers who are encountering these on newspapers and websites and so on are seeing it, I think, you know, that's what they're inclined to think. But here's the problem. You know, so the reader sees, you know, that the Michigan Attorney General, for example, just announced, you know, a massive settlement from, let's say, Target Corporation because of its data breach in 2013. This happened just last year. And it's tempting to think, you know, wow, like our attorney general was really aggressive. He went out and took on this major corporation and brought all this money back to harm consumers. But that's hardly ever the case, because really what happens is there's AGs, attorneys general from other states that are doing all the hard work. And many of these times, Michigan is literally offering a signature to get this money and then shoots out a press release. You know, as I mentioned in the article, like, we just need to be very skeptical about these claims. We don't have award banquets for children who feed their parents, and we shouldn't give substantial credit to an attorney general who simply scribbles a signature on a page and collects money.
Now, you ran against Mr. Schuette in 2014 and lost. So how do you respond to those who wonder if this editorial and the motivation for this study is basically sour grapes?
You know, look, I've been an advocate for consumers for a very long time, and it certainly was never going to be the case that one defeat at the ballot box was going to keep me from continuing to do the same.
What do you hope might come from this study of enforcement of consumer protection laws for Michigan's consumers?
I think foremost, the public just needs to be aware of how bad it is in Michigan, in this particular area of the law, how bad enforcement is. The Attorney General has many responsibilities, but one of the most important ones, certainly since Frank Kelly left office, is protecting consumers. And it's hard to hold your elected attorney general accountable if you don't know how good a job they're doing. And so this study, certainly, you know, for me, caring especially about Michigan, but really for people all across the United States, is an attempt to let them see how their attorney general is using his or her powers. And I hope this is the beginning of an important conversation. And I hope there's scrutiny. I hope there's scrutiny by the press. You know, when they get press releases from the attorney general with these really large eye-popping payouts, I hope they take the additional step and ask hard questions like, you know, what role did you play here? Did you lead this case? Did you do more than sign a signature? Those are important questions that have to be asked and that the citizens have a right to know.
MSU Law Professor Mark Totten. You'll find his guest editorial at bridgemi.com. Mark, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
When contacted, Attorney General Bill Schuette's office pushed back strongly against the assertion that consumer protections have lagged under his tenure. His spokesperson sent us a statement which reads in part, and I quote, "Mr. Totten's commentary focuses narrowly on his perceived shortcomings but ignores the fuller picture of what Bill Schuette has done to help Michigan consumers." The AG's office then supplied a lengthy, detailed rebuttal, and we have posted that along with Professor Totten's interview. You'll find them at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Coming up, a Traverse City company has managed to tunnel its way into doing business with NFL teams. We'll meet the man who saw opportunity in teams' pregame festivities. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it's time for another edition of Theater Talk, our very first of the new year. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is with us now with the latest look at productions from professional theater companies all around the state. But let's kick things off, David, by starting to talk a little bit about the state of professional theater in Michigan. How healthy is it overall?
It's been a very strong year for theater, with roughly half the current season, which ends at the end of May, completed. I would say that there's a general health of the community. There are some 80 theater companies, professional, that are active in the state with productions this year. There are more than that that kind of come and go, you know, in and out of production, but about 75 to 80 have scheduled professional plays and musicals this season. And by professional, we mean that the actors and musicians get paid. This is distinct from community theaters, where the actors and directors, though often very, very good, do the work on a volunteer basis. But, you know, the biggest challenge facing professional theater in Michigan is actually awareness. We're doing what we can here with Theater Talk and with our website, EncoreMichigan.com. And we're going to convert to a 501c3 this year to see if we can get some help for expansion. But, you know, our website and this radio segment is really the only source of information these days for these 75 to 80 theaters that's gathered in one place. The mainstream media, the newspapers and their websites, hardly cover theater anymore.
There have been so many cutbacks. Things have just changed so much.
Yeah. And they say that arts coverage doesn't click as much as celebrity coverage or, you know, automotive coverage or things like that. So they've really eliminated it. So what we have so many theaters that people don't know about. So the people in Trenton, let's say, in Downriver, they're getting to know the Open Book Theater, which has been there just a couple of years. The folks in Pinckney, they've come to know the Dio Dinner and Entertainment Theater. Kalamazoo, the people there for the most part know about Farmer's Alley. And, of course, our friends up in Alpena, they know all about Thunder Bay. But what I'd like to see increase is the people of Dearborn aware of Open Book, the people of Northville knowing more about the Dio and not just Tipping Point, which is right there in Northville.
Sure, but maybe drive a bit.
Drive a bit. Get a little bit outside your zone. Explore some of these new theaters, which are doing wonderful work.
So that would be, I can tell, the challenge for 2018.
Awareness.
Awareness.
Awareness of the breadth and wealth of professional theater that we have beyond Broadway and Detroit and, you know, Broadway and Grand Rapids.
Which are fun.
They're
love
wonderful.
Them.
The touring, the big touring shows are
absolutely
wonderful.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, we're going to start by talking about one, Cirque du Soleil Crystal.
That's right. This is the first of the Cirque du Soleil shows that's performed on ice, I understand. I've only seen one of these in Las Vegas, and, you know, a lot of people
love
this show.
Yes.
So Crystal not only ties into the ice stage while the Red Wings are out of town because it's at Little Caesars Arena, but it's also the name of the central character in the story of a girl who explores her imagination as the performers for this show are drawn from the world-class ice skaters and acrobats. So that opens this week on Wednesday night and runs through the weekend. Tickets start at $40, I understand.
Okay, so that's pretty doable for a night. Certainly cheaper than seeing it in Vegas.
Yes, I would say.
Now we go to Ferndale to the opposite side, from Little Caesars Arena to a very intimate venue.
A very small theater. The Slipstream Initiative in Ferndale holds maybe 50 or so people, but very, very small space. And they have a new play called Tales of the Mitten. And they commissioned it, and so it's a brand new, you know, world premiere, you know, basically. But this is a play about what it's like to be an actor in one of the 80 theater companies that we just talked about operating, especially the non-equity theaters like the Slipstream, like the Encore Theater in Dexter, like Farmer's Alley.
Where and just so people are sure, what does that difference mean, equity versus non-equity?
Yeah, so equity theaters, they have a very set and, you know, pretty substantial scale that the actors get paid. There's a lot of union rules and things like that. But a lot of the theaters that we cover, like the Encore Musical Theater in Dexter, Slipstream, these are non-equity theaters where the actors get paid, but they have day jobs that are really paying their bills, or maybe they have a spouse that's supportive of their art. And this is a play about the pain of auditions and the low pay, but also the rewards that are earned from creating the art. You know, it's a backstage kind of play. And I talked to the director, Bailey Boudreau, who directed it, about what inspired the play.
We wanted to showcase what it was like to be an actor in Michigan, but make it not necessarily only for theater people. Of auditioning, of being a person of color or a female in the industry, what that means, what that looks like, what kind of sacrifices you have to make, what things you put up with just to follow this crazy art form that we do. And originally, I had asked Luna, our associate artistic director, to write it and do it as a one-woman show about auditioning in Michigan. And then she said, can I have Dan Johnson? And I said, absolutely, because he's a pretty consummate actor in the area. And then they just poured their own experiences into it. And it's really, really lovely.
So it seems like if you work in theater or if you enjoy going to theater, you're going to get something out of this Tale of the Mitten.
Absolutely, yeah.
At the Slipstream Initiative in Ferndale. Now we go to Chelsea, to the Purple Rose, where certainly Jeff Daniels has been making his mark on theater in this state for years now.
Yes, well, the Purple Rose is really not only probably the best equity theater in Michigan, but perhaps one of the best equity regional theaters in the country. And they do have a brand new play called Flint, written by Jeff Daniels. And it's about the water crisis, but it's a lot more than that. And I think what it's important to know is that the play doesn't look to lay blame on any individuals. It doesn't form any conclusions. This is about the people of Flint. And Jeff talked to Lester Graham recently about the play.
I don't have a clue as to who did what, who knew what, when. There are people investigating that. I'll be interested to see when the report hits the desk. But what I care about are the people. And that's what drama can do. That's what a play can do. We're supposed to, you know, go on an expedition into the human condition. And so the play focuses on four people, a white couple and a black couple, who were left behind. We never get to talk to those people. We never see those people. We don't hear from those people again. They don't get lawyers. They don't get PR firms to handle that. They just watch Buick City leave. And then they look up and their water's yellow and they're being told it's safe. The play is about those people.
Yeah, that sounds really good. So that will be opening up. And when it's at the Purple Rose, it's there for a while, right?
Yes, it opens this month and it'll run into March.
Good. So you got a chance to get to the Purple Rose and see Flint. And then we head to the Wharton Center in Lansing with music and lyric by Sarah Bareilles, Waitress.
Yes, this is what I call really a mainstream people pleaser. Mm-hmm. It's Waitress. It's had a very successful run on Broadway. This is the musical based on the 2007 film about a waitress in a terrible marriage. She finds herself pregnant. She doesn't want to tell her husband, and she's kind of plotting to establish her independence from him with her coming baby. The music is fun. The tunes are not exactly the kind of songs that you'll be singing the next day. That's a tough bar to hit these days, I think. But it is a very solid, fun musical. And it's a nice show despite the fact that the story turns, for people who've seen the film, to her having an affair with her gynecologist, which is
okay.
which is a little bit of an awkward plot twist. But the music is good. Let's have a listen.
Was from the Broadway soundtrack with Tony Winter, Jesse Miller in the title role of Jenna. And it's kind of interesting. Songwriter Sarah Bareilles is so versatile. She actually went on to take over that leading role on Broadway when Jesse Miller left. And Bareilles is going to be playing Mary Magdalene on the live TV performance of Jesus Christ Superstar that's happening Easter Sunday on NBC. So she's making waves as an actress.
She's quite talented. You know, they talk about a triple threat as somebody who can act, sing, and dance. She's a different kind of triple or quadruple threat, I would say.
Well, you can get the details of all of these productions and the rest of them. As we said, there are so many good professional theaters waiting to be discovered in Michigan. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, as always, thank you.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. There are well-known fight songs that celebrate a sports team, a college. But poet Cal Freeman's fight songs are not about hailing to the victors or victory for MSU. His new collection of poems, titled Fight Songs, are about unsung, little-noticed lives, about underdogs, and about animals, plants, and nature. Cal Freeman grew up in Detroit. He won the Divine Poetry Fellowship, and he's been nominated for multiple Pushcart Prizes in both creative nonfiction and poetry. And you have often heard him reviewing works of other writers for our Michigan Bookmark feature right here on Stateside. Cal Freeman, welcome. It's very good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
So how do you describe the themes that you're exploring in this collection, Fight Songs?
There are a number of themes that are really important to me in this book. One of them is social justice, certainly. Ecological consciousness and advocacy is really important to me in this book as well. And then I think local history is another touchstone for me that I always come back to in my poems.
And what are some of the aspects of local history that you want to share with your readers?
Well, being a current resident of Dearborn, Michigan, I think the history of sort of labor activism in our region, UAW activism. My mother's uncle, Jim Sullivan, was one of the folks who was involved in the 1941 Rouge strike. So a lot of those stories are really meaningful to me, and that sort of history of resistance and activism I think is still applicable, you know, in the contemporary world. So I like to draw from that and figure out how it can inform some of the things we're struggling with right now.
So many of these poems, they're like very stark black and white photos, maybe of a ruined building like the one that's kind of on the cover, maybe of a crime scene or someone who's overdosed. What draws you to explore these grittier, really often melancholy stories? You're a sunny guy.
Yeah, I think most of the places I've lived have all been kind of Rust Belt Americana places. And I think especially post-2008, you've dealt with a lot of things like, you know, evictions, opioid crisis. I've lost personal friends well before their time to some of those issues. And so I think that's what draws me to them. Just having grown up in Warrendale in West Detroit, and then as a teenager, having lived in Southgate, both very working class places, both places where they were middle class places, but they were precariously so. So seeing some people kind of slip off the margins in those places where I've lived, having folks in my own family who struggle with issues of mental illness, I think all those elements, just being in touch with people who struggle with those kinds of issues, it inevitably finds its way into my work. And I think it makes me a more empathetic writer, hopefully. That's really important in poetry, to have some consciousness of social justice underpinning your work. And it's a trick to do that maybe without lapsing into didacticism or sort of bald political statement. You know, I still try to make it poetic, make it lyrical, but I do want to advocate maybe for those who are vulnerable and can't always speak for themselves.
Who don't have a voice. And, right. And not just people, but cities. In fact, I'm wondering, right, with that in mind, would you read us the poem titled Toledo? Because it's your take on a Rust Belt theme that has been felt over and over in this part of the country.
Sure. Toledo. A Jeep Wrangler looms above the pitted lot of the closed-down Chrysler plant. Toledo's emptiness is the one misnomer that can bring the game birds back to patchwork green spaces sutured over post-industrial scars. Toledo has towering blue spans that cross the river in a searing wind through trees where the Maumee Bay writhes in its torrent. Toledo has gulls that cry like puppies over produce tumbling from the trucks at weekend market. Toledo has a listless energy that staggers through birdsong and hypodermic needles in botanical gardens. Jackals, bamboo shoots in the lairs of pandas at the zoo. Storm doors with rusted handles stuffed with health insurance offers, handbills for pizza, epiphanic notes blown out beneath the greening sky.
So many images. So with that poem, how did that come to be? Did you walk around the town, and is that truly, were you taking notes? What did it take to write that?
Yeah, I think walking is an important part of my process. Walking around cities, walking down to the creek at the end of the road. Yeah, and I spent a lot of time last year or so in Toledo hanging out with some singer-songwriters I met down there. A good friend of mine, Ben Stolitz, lives in Toledo. So visiting him, walking around, looking at the city, drawing upon memories as a kid, taking day trips down there with my family to the zoo and things. My wife and I like to go to the botanical gardens. It's really nice down there. And so I have spent a lot of time there. I have walked around taking mental notes, as you said. So and walking and sort of taking in images is a really important part of writing poetry for me.
You do a gorgeous job of taking those images because it feels like a poetic photograph. How long did it take you, roughly, to put this collection together?
This collection, I think most of the poems in here are 3 years old or less.
Okay.
So it took me a few years, and I had a lot of help from some really brilliant friends and readers. My friend Michael Laughlin helped me out with a lot of poems in this, and then my editor, Todd Swift, is a great editor, and he really helped me, specifically cutting a few poems that just weren't up to snuff or didn't really quite belong in the book. thematically. You get so close to the stuff, sometimes you lose perspective on what's working and what isn't. So
it certainly seems that when it comes to creating art in the form of poetry, you have to be patient. You can't force it.
Yeah.
And you can't expect instant results, right?
Absolutely.
Is that hard to get across to your students?
It is. And teaching is a somewhat contradictory space when it comes to teaching writing, because you're putting due dates and things on the course calendar, and then you're telling them writing's this long process that you have to live with, and you have to revisit your work, and yet you're giving them deadlines for things. So it's a hard sell for students who are dealing with the busyness of college life and often working part-time jobs to put themselves through school and things. It's hard to teach writing as a process, and you got to build it into the course calendar as much as possible. We're going to do this part of the paper, and then we're going to do a revision here. But yeah, it's tough.
I can imagine. You also have a number of poems in this book about nature. What is it that you want to say to us as your readers about plants and animals and nature, particularly here in the Midwest?
Just that we're adjacent to over a fifth of the world's fresh water supply, and that needs to be protected, and we need to speak truth to power when it comes to people who might want to raid some of those natural resources in our region.
Fight Songs. Cal Freeman, thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Coming up, why it can be so hard for people to accept that they or a family member are not to blame for their mental illness.
What makes this more complicated is the fact that we still don't have any objective markers of psychiatric illness.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Turning a passion into a profitable business. For many people, it's a dream, but for Paul Britton, it's a reality. He owns Britton Studios in Traverse City, and he's been designing stuff for major sports events for decades, from banners at Wrigley Field to giant signs at the Daytona International Speedway, even recently a 3D foam sculpture that lines the entrance tunnel for the Denver Broncos. But as Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wanshura reports, Britton began his career at the very bottom.
It all started when he was studying architecture at the University of Detroit. Back then, he painted rush party banners for fraternities and sororities. That was in 1984.
If I painted three banners a night, I could make $30, which was pretty important for a senior in college.
One day, Paul was in his dorm room when he heard a radio ad for a banner design contest to celebrate the Tigers, who had just made it to the World Series. The winner got box seats to a World Series game and $500.
I decided that if I was going to enter, I was going to paint to win.
He taped a bunch of butcher paper together and started painting.
And I spent probably 30 straight hours and a 12-pack of beer on that banner and painted the best work that I could do, my own little masterpiece that said, WLLZ rocks the Tiger, and the baseball was on fire breaking through the banner, it appeared.
The finished banner was huge, 12 feet by 30 feet, and it blew away the competition. In fact, second place was some guy who just spray-painted Go Tigers on a bedsheet. Paul says he was almost embarrassed. His banner was so much bigger and so much better than any others.
But it was an eye-opener for me that there might be additional projects or additional. There didn't seem to be competition in the world of big banners.
Days later, Paul had an idea for an even bigger banner. This one would hang from General Motors headquarters in Detroit. He called GM and begged for a meeting with someone, anyone, and a guy from public relations obliged. An hour into that meeting, Paul found himself walking down a hallway to meet General Motors CEO Roger Smith.
But we walked right into Roger Smith's office. He said, "Show him what you got." I put it on his desk, and he looked at it, and he leaned back in his chair, and he said, "Can you have that banner done in 3 days?" And I said, "Yes, I can."
Paul Britton's business grew from hand-painted banners to high-tech industrial printers. he learned to hire, manage people, and ultimately give them control. Today, Britton employs over 300 people.
Yes, you think you can do it all yourself, but you're never going to grow unless you learn to trust other people. I can honestly say that I have 18 or 19 of the largest digital printing machines, and I don't even know how to turn them on.
But once in a while, a project big enough comes along where Paul Britton just can't help himself. A project like the Denver Broncos player entry tunnel. The tunnel is big, over 20 feet long. The three Broncos that make up the tunnel each weigh hundreds of pounds. Still, workers have only 5 minutes to set everything up and just 4 to take it all down. That all has to be done before the game can start. When the workers tried assembling the new tunnel at the field for the first time, it took them an hour and a half just to set it up. Days before the Broncos' season opener on Monday Night Football, the team was ready to get the inflatable tunnel back out. When Paul got that news, he jumped on a plane and headed west.
We had a very, very dramatic and exciting 3 or 4 days.
The main problem was the new tunnel was designed for a level surface, but the football field was sloped for drainage. Just a little bit, but enough to throw the whole thing off and make it really hard to set up. So while the Broncos were thinking about Plan B, Paul and his team began working on a solution.
Time kind of stops when you have a project like that that needs to get done. Time seems to be a little bit irrelevant. It's about pushing forward to find the solution. And a lot of innovation happens in those pressured moments.
They compensated and made some adjustments for the sloped field, simplified some of the mechanics required to lift the tunnel, and on the morning of game day, they shaved the setup time from an hour and 30 minutes to 5. The Broncos decided they'd give it a shot for the game that night.
Very excited when it went up. I think it met all of our expectations as far as the look, but I wasn't totally relieved until it was down and off.
That's Liz Coates. She's the game entertainment manager for the Broncos.
It went great.
Okay. All right, now let's get out of the way.
Paul Britton believes there's more opportunities to work with other NFL teams in the future. But for 2018, he's got his eyes set on the collegiate sports market, where there's a lot more than 32 teams.
Dan Wanshura hosts The Green Room, a weekly arts and culture podcast from Interlochen Public Radio. You can subscribe to that show on iTunes, and you can see photos of the Denver Broncos' new tunnel on our website, michiganradio.org. Talking about mental illness goes hand in hand with talking about the stigma, that fear of being judged, of having one's symptoms blamed on bad behavior rather than a disease. That stigma keeps people from seeking the medical help they need for their mental illness. My next guest hopes new innovations in brain imaging, genetics, and other technologies can help us objectively recognize that mental illness is just that, an illness. Dr. David Rosenberg is a professor of psychiatry and neuroscience at Wayne State University, and he joins us now for another installment of our Minding Michigan series. Dr. Rosenberg, you've written that as a psychiatrist, one of the toughest aspects of your job is telling parents and their children that they are not to blame for their mental health problems. Why is that?
Well, we've come such a long way, but the stigma remains huge. Think about it. For any other type of medical illness, there's a natural empathy and sympathy. And I think in a lot of cases with mental illness, that's the case. But there's still this feeling that it's under the power of a child or their family, that if the parents were good, if they were better.
So what did I do wrong, doctor?
What did I do wrong? Mm. How did I go wrong? It's my fault. And I look at it, for example, with diabetes. Would somebody be blaming their pancreas for not secreting insulin? Would you be yelling at a child or a parent that you're not good parents because your kid's pancreas isn't working properly? It just doesn't make any sense.
And they don't, so they have a hard time accepting when you tell them it is not your fault?
You can't see it. There are no current objective markers of psychiatric illness. If you go to any clinic in the country, in Arkansas, in Michigan, in New York, and you get a sugar reading, It's going to be basically the same wherever you are. But that's not the case in psychiatry. And so as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, by far one of the hardest parts of my job is convincing good parents and good children that they're not to blame for the illness. And it's really a societal problem because children with mental health problems are the diagnostic and therapeutic orphans of American healthcare.
How so?
Well, in a system that we have, it's dominated by politics and money. Who's going to pay the bills? And it's probably why we have Medicare rather than Pedicare, and literally millions of American children who can't get good mental health care. Despite more information about it, despite people talking about it, it remains elusive for the vast majority of children and their families in this country.
And then when you think of the stress that having, let's say, an anxious child or an obsessive compulsive child, and you say parents feeling guilty, getting angry because they're only human, so then you're setting up years and years without proper treatment of all kinds of negative dynamics within that family.
That's exactly right. And we know that the best predictor of a good response to treatment is an accurate diagnosis. But that's far more difficult than it sounds. I've written 3 textbooks on using medicines in children and adolescents with emotional and behavioral problems. And I never do that lightly. I always look for non-medication interventions. When the diagnosis is made correctly, when the medicines are used correctly, though, they can be literally life-saving for children and their families. But what makes this more complicated is the fact that we still don't have any objective markers of psychiatric illness.
And you are working on that, and you wrote a piece in theconversation.com talking about the ways and techniques that you're trying to really get in there and get that objective identification. Particularly, you're doing some real interesting things using the latest brain imaging technology to figure out what's going on with obsessive compulsive disorder. Tell us what you're doing.
Well, a lot of us builds on history because there are many bona fide medical and neurologic conditions today that have had all of the stigma years ago. So if it were 1917 rather than 2017, epilepsy had all of the stigma and was actually considered a psychiatric condition. And here's the kicker. Back in the Middle Ages, people with epilepsy were considered to be possessed by the devil. So up until the 1930s, when people were considered to be lunatics and to have a psychiatric problem locked up in lunatic asylums, that was actually considered advanced thinking. Because now they no longer thought you were possessed by the devil. They were crazy. Who else would urinate and defecate on themselves? Who else would shake all about but a crazy person? And it was a psychiatrist by the name of Hans Berger who in 1924 discovered something called the electroencephalogram, or EEG, and found that the cause was electrical abnormalities in the brain.
And you could see it right there on the reading.
You could see it, and even more, based on the pattern and where the abnormality was. Was it in the front of your brain, the side of the brain, the back of the brain? That would determine and dictate an entirely different treatment. That's what we're trying to do because we believe that knowledge heals, and it's going to defeat ignorance and stigma every time. Without it, it makes it more complicated, and our goal is not to replace good physicians, not to replace good psychologists and therapists. You always need a good doctor, but to give them added tools to be able to see the illness and to identify specific subtypes of the illness.
And what you've done with these brain imaging studies with OCD patients, you've actually been able to identify a part of the brain that is not firing right.
We find areas of the brain that aren't firing right, and we also find that not all obsessive compulsive disorder is the same.
So just like not all cancers are the same.
Not all cancers, not all high blood pressure is the same. Not all diabetes is the same. There are insulin-dependent diabetes, type 1 diabetes. non-insulin dependent diabetes, type 2 diabetes. And guess what? If you treat them the same, it's disastrous. Insulin can be life-saving for an insulin dependent diabetic. It could be very dangerous and not helpful in someone who has type 2 diabetes.
So for instance, your brain imaging studies, what kind of technology and tests are you using to get these results?
It's really like something out of science fiction. It's unimaginable. And the technology we have 15, 20 years ago, we could never have seen the things that we're seeing.
The detailing, yeah.
We can measure precise physiology, how the brain functions, how the brain networks talk to each other and communicate with each other, the brain's chemistry, details about the structure, the size, the form. And I think something else that's so critical is that when I say we're looking to identify new subtypes of the illness, I believe in the next 10 years there'll be 10 or more different subtypes of depression, 10 or more subtypes of obsessive compulsive disorder. And our research, our MRIs, is very clear that in a child with obsessive compulsive disorder who has fears about contamination, washes their hands over and over again, as compared to a child who checks the door locks over and over again, their brains look completely different.
Different things are going on. I was struck that, for example, you found in some patients there's something called the anterior cingulate cortex that doesn't give the all-clear signal. That makes total sense. So the brain isn't satisfied that things are good.
That's exactly right.
And you can see that. What does it do to patients and families when you can go, look right here, let me show you this. What's it do for them?
It's a game changer. Pure and simple, it just validates them in many ways, even though we always reassure and tell them that this is research. This is not clinically indicated yet. We hope someday that it will have a clinical use, but right now they are being the heroes, the pioneers, to help hopefully other children and their families in the future. That being said, when they're able to actually see a brain scan and see a clear abnormality, something that isn't working properly in the brain, rather than being fearful, they finally feel validated. And I remember one parent and child both exclaiming that, you know, everyone's always told us this is all in your head, and it is all in my head, but I can see it. And most exciting of all is with some of our more recent research is that we find that with appropriate treatment, those brain abnormalities can normalize with effective treatment.
So you can help pinpoint treatment.
Pinpoint the treatment and pick the particular treatment that's most likely to be effective. So, for example, we find different chemical and functional changes in children who respond to cognitive behavioral therapy than those who respond to medication treatment. And some who need the combination treatment may have different patterns in addition.
You're at an early stage with this. So where do you hope this work will be able to lead you and other psychiatrists?
Very early stage. And, you know, I think at Wayne State, we are collaborating with the University of Michigan, the University of Calgary on a major grant funded by the National Institute of Mental Health studying obsessive compulsive behaviors, not just in children with obsessive compulsive disorder, but depression, anxiety, tic, Tourette, autism spectrum conditions. And we are now using these brain imaging tools in combination with sophisticated genetic analyses in the same children and their families. And we think that we can begin to pinpoint the genes that are involved and how that impacts brain function. So it's really a brave new world where, as we hope, knowledge is going to heal and defeat the pervasive stigma that still exists.
And then I think I hear you say the other side of that fight is access to this kind of technology for all patients, that you talk about kids being orphans. And I'm sure you don't want to see a world where some have access and others are left to muddle along.
This is a huge societal problem, because one of the striking things that I find when I talk with legislators, administrators, doctors, others, policymakers, is everyone agrees that more mental health services are needed, more child and adolescent psychiatrists, more psychologists. Then when you get around to who's going to pay for it, that's when people typically run for the hills. And what's sad is that oftentimes people can be easily convinced and showed the enormous cost to society if you don't correct or deal with these problems.
Look at our prisons.
Look at the prisons, look at the shootings that occur, look at everywhere. And in prison, as you mentioned, at least a third, probably more, may have schizophrenia and other very devastating illnesses. So we know the cost in terms of to society. We know that the economic burden is huge. Sometimes, though, in a system where you have to balance a budget in a single year, people don't seem to care as much about that.
A voice from the trenches, definitely. Dr. David Rosenberg, who is chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Neuroscience at Wayne State University and the Detroit Medical Center. Thanks for sharing your work with us, Doctor.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Herron, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.